Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, today is World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. We'll learn how to spot the signs of elder abuse and what to do about it. Also, Jay Fox will have a conversation with Republican Ohio U.S. Senator John Husted. Jay will also have details on how proposed changes to Medicaid could significantly impact rural maternal health care in central Ohio. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, national studies show as many as 1 in 10 seniors is a victim of elder abuse. Last year, Ohioans made more than 40,000 referrals for elder abuse. Director Matt Damschroeder is with the Ohio Department of Jobs and Family Services and is here to talk to us today about the resources available to help those in need, signs to look for among your loved ones, and how you can help. Thanks for joining us, Director Damschroeder.
Thank you.
For those who may have never heard of it, how do you describe what elder abuse is?
So elder abuse can take many different forms, and the signs of elder abuse, you know, across the spectrum of different types of abuse would be a lack of basic amenities, a worsening living environment, unexplained injuries, unusual behavior changes. On the financial side, things like unpaid bills, new credit cards, or increased cash withdrawals from accounts.
That's quite a few, kind of a broad spectrum of things to look for. What are other signs of elder abuse that you can look for in your loved ones if you suspect something might be wrong?
Yeah, so, you know, individuals, as they age, you know, just like children become vulnerable to different types of abuse or exploitation, but just, you know, in some ways they're similar, in some ways they're different. And so it's super important for all of us to keep an eye out for some of these types of things, some of these types of signs for either family members, you know, neighbors or others in our community, because, you know, the different types of elder abuse are across the spectrum, certainly physical, sexual, psychological abuse, you know, as well as self-neglect, neglect by others, abandonment, or the financial exploitation that we often hear about.
What are the resources that are available for someone that is in a situation where elder abuse is involved?
Yeah, just like the types of abuse can run a spectrum, certainly the types of supports that are available locally run the spectrum also to match up with those different types of abuse. So in categories where there is neglect, like in the case of self-neglect for a person, you know, living on their own, counties and other providers locally can assist that person with helping to, you know, maintain a healthy living environment, or even help them navigate the long-term care system, you know, if moving out of their home into a nursing home or other setting is important. In cases of physical or sexual abuse, certainly law enforcement can play a role in helping to protect that individual and holding others to account. And then on the financial side, you know, again, that we often hear about, you know, there's resources locally to help educate individuals both about how to protect their finances, but also how to think in a proactive and protective way about their own finances. You know, the most important thing for us to think about is that there isn't shame in having, you know, when a person is a victim of these type of things, and, you know, it's important for that person to advocate for themselves when they're able to reach out for assistance, or others in their lives, family members, folks in the community, neighbors, you know, medical professionals and others to reach out when necessary to connect to resources.
We're joined today by Director Matt Damschroeder with the Ohio Department of Jobs and Family Services. June is Elder Abuse Awareness Month, and elder abuse referrals to Adult Protective Services rose nearly 10% in the state of Ohio last year. That was about 112 referrals per day, almost 41,000 for the entire year. Why is this rise in the number of referrals actually a good thing?
Yeah, on one hand, you know, like you said, it is a good thing when referrals rise, because that indicates that we are getting our message out to individuals, empowering Ohio's senior citizens so that they know that they can advocate for themselves and get assistance, and also that others, family members, others in the community are taking the appropriate steps and being aware of the welfare of their family members and people in the community. So it's very important to understand for folks, family members, individual senior citizens, other than the community, that they can make that referral. They can raise attention and awareness to a potential situation. They don't necessarily have to solve the problem themselves, but seeing something and saying something and using the hotline that is 1-855-OHIO-APS to report something confidentially and anonymously can really start the process.
And you've kind of touched on it, but what would you say is the first step someone should take if they suspect elder abuse, whether it's a neighbor, a friend, or a family member?
Yeah, the first step is the easiest, that is, being aware and noticing something's going on. Then with that information, they can call or can report something online. As I mentioned, the elder abuse hotline is 1-855-OHIO-APS. That's 1-855-644-6277. Individuals can also report suspected elder abuse online at aps.jfs.ohio.gov. And again, all of those reporting mechanisms are confidential and anonymous.
We all kind of play a part in helping to combat elder abuse. What are some suggestions you can give to any of us that are out and about and definitely have elderly neighbors, friends, family members? What are some ways we can help combat this?
Yeah, being aware and educating yourself is really kind of the most important thing. We have a number of resources online that are available for folks who want more information. ODG, the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services, continues its Age Safely Ohio campaign. And that website is aging.ohio.gov/elder abuse. And that has detailed information about elder abuse warning signs, and insights on how older Ohioans can avoid scams. And there's a number of resources there at agesafelyohio.org where folks can learn more, explore more, and become aware of the signs of potential elder abuse in their life.
Director Matt Damschroeder with the Ohio Department of Jobs and Family Services speaking with us today about elder abuse during Elder Abuse Awareness Month. Is there anything that we have not yet touched on that you wanted to make sure to include today?
No, I think just underscoring the importance that each of us plays in awareness and protecting senior citizens in our community. As Ohio continues to grow, we also grow as our senior population. So we have over 3 million adults in Ohio that are over 60. So we have a lot of people that all of us need to be thoughtful about and looking out for. And there's a lot of information available at agesafelyohio.org.
Director Damschroeder, I thank you so much for your time today on this important topic.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, if any senior in your life needs help, please call Ohio's Elder Abuse Hotline at 1-855-OHIO-APS. That's 1-855-644-6277. You can also visit agesafelyohio.org.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Former Ohio Lieutenant Governor John Husted is now almost half a year into his new role as one of our two Ohio United States Senators. He joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about his transition, life in Washington, D.C., and his future plans. Welcome, Senator. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for hosting me.
What's a typical work day like for a United States Senator? What time do you start? What do you do all day? How does it go?
Oh, boy. Well, you know what? I wish I knew what the typical day was. I'll try to do my best. Usually I get up around 6:15, 6:30. I go work out. So I work out and then I'm ready for my first meeting at 8 o'clock, which is usually meetings with constituents. We usually have like this thing called a Husted huddle where we can't meet with everybody who wants to meet. So we try to, like, it's part of like speed dating with everybody. I walk around the room, talk to them all, talk about the things that they're interested in. And then I give them some remarks about what we're trying to do in the U.S. Senate. And then we start just meetings or committee hearings that go throughout the morning. And then around noon, just a little before noon, you have a vote, you do votes, and then you go in and you have a lunch with your other Republican colleagues to talk about policy issues, things like that. Leave that, come out and do more votes, then more meetings, and then evening events. Usually you're scheduled for 2-3 evening events to go speak to groups, associations, like the farmers, the railroad operators, the people that have events up here for you. And then sometimes in the evening, I have to preside over the Senate. So I might find myself there at the dais till around 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And then I come home to my little apartment here and I read, catch up on emails, and then start it over all again the next day. And we're here typically Monday through Friday. And then hopefully get 1 week off a month to come back and do things in Ohio. So it's a pretty all-in kind of schedule.
What would be an example of something that could happen in Ohio that might require you to leave D.C. and return home, other than the obvious, like a family emergency?
Yeah, well, it would have to be a pretty big thing because they need my vote. Like, we're typically, the Democrats don't provide any votes for the things that are going on around here. And so we can't afford to lose any Republican votes. And if one or two Republican members is missing or decides to vote against a particular issue, you know, you got to be here. Like, you can't move the country's agenda along if people are not here casting votes when they need them. So it's got to be something pretty serious to get you out of there. Although it does, things like that can happen from time to time, family related or a loss of a loved one or something like that.
So like the paper mill closure announcement and then the subsequent Band-Aid over that situation, that's a good example?
That would be an example, although we did that one on a Friday when we didn't have to be in D.C. I think it was that was the timing on it.
How do you manage constituent expectations of your time in person and your response times to calls and emails with a schedule like that?
Well, it's difficult. We try to meet with everybody that we can here in D.C., especially because if people make a special trip to come out to Washington to meet with their representatives, I always try to connect with them somehow, even if it's briefly, or make sure if it's a specific issue. I have policy staff that specialize in certain areas, and we try to connect them with the right kind of the appropriate team member to help them navigate their situation. So we really work hard at trying to do that. And then we have, you know, regional offices where people can go. But we try to be responsive. We try to get their calls to the places that they want them to be. If they're calling to complain about something, my team will log that, and then they share that with me at the end of the week. I hear about what the calls were about, what the themes were, what things were. But if there's a specific issue, like somebody can't get a passport, somebody is seeing their veterans' benefits being upheld, then we get them to a caseworker to help them sort that out as quickly as possible.
Now, you recently opened several Ohio offices in addition to the one you had in Columbus. What purpose do these regional offices serve? Is it to, you know, micromanage those specific areas?
Yeah, well, we have regional representatives that work out of those offices that it can either go to events in the community or host events or handle requests for meetings that people might have. So we try to use those offices for our to house our team and to serve the public.
Now, when the summertime comes, are you going to make a statewide sweep when you're on vacation?
Yes. I wouldn't call it a vacation.
Well, okay, when you have a vacation from D.C., Senator.
We call it work period. We call it state work periods. But, yes, that's what I'll do. I'll travel around. I like to visit businesses, meet with their employees. Those are the things that I really, I'm really gravitate to, because you get to meet people who are out there working, talking with them about their lives, and then talk with their employers about what we can do to help make sure that those jobs are out there for people to keep and thrive in for many years to come.
So that being said, what are you focused on right now in terms of legislative priorities?
Well, the big deal is the budget. I am very concerned about the direction of the federal budget. We have nearly $37 trillion in national debt. That's over 106,000 a person. And you're a new child born into this country, you're strapped with that debt. You did nothing to deserve it. I consider what's going on generational theft. And I want to balance this budget. I know we're not going to do that immediately, but we have to put our country on the track to be able to do that. And that's important. I want to preserve, though, the tax cuts for families and small businesses that are in there. But I also don't want to overbake that cake. It's got to, any tax cut has to come with a subsequent spending cut so that we can afford this and move toward a balanced budget. So I honestly consider the common sense background that I had in state government balancing budgets for so many years. I'm just trying to be that voice here in Washington.
How do you think we got so far off track?
It's pretty simple. They don't have to balance the budget. There's no constitutional requirement. In Ohio, we have to balance the budget. So people largely act responsibly because they have to. If we keep cutting taxes, Democrats are going to have to hang with us and start cutting some of this federal spending. And what it ends up in is multi-trillion dollar deficits and $37 trillion in national debt. And it's, because no one wants to blink. I'm just saying, look, we can't keep doing this. We can't keep doing this to our kids and to the future of our country. Let's stop being, so ideological, and let's get the job done.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was recently in Ohio as part of an effort to get Ohio on the bus with regard to the Constitutional Convention. There hasn't been one since 1787. What's the mood in Washington, D.C. regarding that push from all those states?
Well, that's always a dangerous thing to do, because as much as you might want to advance the cause of things that you care about, you could also have the cause of things that you don't like advanced as well. And so I've always got to be careful about changing this Constitution that served us well. Although I do think that perhaps one constitutional amendment we could pass is a balanced budget amendment. I do think that there is, other than in a declared time of war, which would have to be declared by the president and Congress, that America should be required to balance its budget. And that's a constitutional amendment I'd go for. But I have a friend who always says that America went off track when we went from layaway to credit cards, right?
Right.
Remember how, many years ago, you put down payments on the things that you want to buy, and then when you'd saved up enough money, then you'd buy it. But credit cards, that's impulse spending. And then you have to pay it back later on versus, hey, do I really want this thing so badly? Because if I do, I got to save and deferred gratification. Your spending habits would be so much differently if that's the approach we took to it.
My grandmother used to call that a false sense of financial reality.
Well, grandma was wise.
Yeah, she was. Hey, at what point do you start campaigning for 2026? That's got to be on your mind at some point.
Well, I have President Trump's endorsement. I have the Ohio Republican Party's endorsement, and I have no opponent at this point in time. So we're in good shape at the moment, but it will come. I'm going to be a targeted race by the Democrats nationally. They've got to beat me to regain the majority in the U.S. Senate. And so I'm be ready for it. But I just always have felt you do a good job serving the public, and that's good campaigning right there. We'll do a good job in my job, and then when 2026 gets here, we'll be ready to be more aggressive with the campaign.
And like you said, at this point, there's no Republican challenger, but that could change. It's not likely to change, but it could.
Yeah, it always can change. But having President Trump's endorsement, having the Ohio Republican Party's endorsement is a big part of helping to avoid a serious primary. But I'll be ready. I'm out there preparing every single day. You know, I'm making a look. I always tell my kids to like just lay a brick every day, and then before long you got a wall. Make a little investment every day. You just got to do your part, and that adds up to the campaign that we want to have, the wall we want to build.
It wouldn't be an interview with Senator Husted without one sports question.
All right. Where are we going with this one?
How many tissues did you use when the Cavs lost?
Well, goodness, that was a missed opportunity, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly with the Celtics, where the Celtics are. I mean, this was just it just setting up perfectly for the Cavs to go back to the NBA Finals. And I mean, Pacers, they dominated that series. You got to give them credit.
They were the only team in the NBA who had Cleveland's number the whole year. And when we drew them, I said, uh-oh.
Well, you know, I have to say one of my former UD Flyers, Obi Toppin, plays for the Pacers. So have a small, you know, place in my heart for the Pacers.
Yeah, but you keep that to yourself because, you know.
I know. I'm not. I want the Cavs. I loved it. I was, like when the Cavs won the NBA title against the Warriors, that was just such an awesome, awesome time, you know. And just a place like Cleveland deserves to get that, you know, a little more often than they have championship-wise.
I would agree with you being a fan of the Cleveland Cavaliers, absolutely.
Just think when the Browns win the Super Bowl, what that's going to be like.
Well, you know what? I'd like to see that before I retire. So if we can do anything about that, that would be very helpful.
Well, we'll see, won't we?
We will. All right, I want to thank Senator John Husted for sharing his time with us. It's always a pleasure, and for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
The state of Ohio is predominantly rural. 83 counties are more than 50% rural, and 65 counties are more than 90% rural. Medicaid covers 47% of all rural births. A new Georgetown University report looks at rural maternal health care and how federal funding cuts will have a direct impact on maternal health care in these areas. And folks, Central Ohio is in the bullseye this time. Elizabeth Wright Barak is a senior fellow at Georgetown University, where they did the study, and we welcome her to Columbus Perspective Magazine. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay. Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Elizabeth, what were the overall findings of the study?
Well, we already knew, because we study health insurance for low-income families, that we knew that Medicaid tends to play a larger role providing health coverage for people living in small towns and rural communities. And we wanted to look more closely at women of childbearing age. And we found that nationally, nearly one in four women in rural communities or small towns rely on Medicaid for their health insurance. And that's about the same in Ohio, about 25%. And we know that in addition to that, Medicaid covers nearly half of all births in rural areas. So for many women living in these communities, Medicaid's the only way that they can stay healthy before, during, and after they give birth. And that coverage allows them to address their chronic health needs, get behavioral or mental health treatment, any of those things before they become pregnant. It allows them to access prenatal care early. And all of that improves their chances of a healthy delivery.
Do the changes that are possible, could they potentially see a return to the use of alternatives like midwives or private doulas?
Well, I know Ohio's done a lot to expand different ways that women might be able to birth in communities, and doulas and midwives are important, but certainly a lot, still, most women have their deliveries in hospitals, and that includes in rural areas. And what's challenging is that even as Ohio and other states are trying to do more to improve maternal and infant health outcomes, the cuts to Medicaid on the table in Congress would really set that progress back. And it particularly would be precarious for rural areas. They already have hospitals that are struggling to stay open or keep their obstetrics units open. And that just means women would have to drive longer to get to in labor to give birth.
I have two children of my own, and I don't know if you have children, but I certainly appreciate and understand the importance of a short distance access to healthcare. If these changes go through, what are the real life possible threats that occur for these rural women and their families?
Rural women and their families are already struggling to get timely health care, right? Where they don't have to drive long distances. And this would just put more pressure on these rural hospitals, especially to stay open. And we don't want that Congress to rush through cuts that means women have to drive 90 miles to give birth.
So if these cuts happen, and we don't know that they will or they won't, and we don't know to what degree of severity they will impact, why would it hit rural areas more than metropolitan areas?
Well, it would hit all areas, but particularly we're concerned about rural communities because they are, you know, that is where a large share of the population relies on Medicaid for their health insurance coverage. And that means Medicaid is a really important economic payer for the community and those local hospitals and services. And when those aren't able to stay open, that makes it harder to get timely care for those families.
Do the Medicaid programs support prenatal vitamins and things of that nature?
Absolutely. I think that's what's so important is that when women become pregnant, they have access to early prenatal care and checkups that checks on the status of their children. But what's really important, too, is that, you know, Ohio expanded Medicaid to low-income adults, and that includes a lot of these women we're talking about who are of childbearing age, and they have that health coverage before they get pregnant. And states like Ohio that have expanded Medicaid and allowed these women to have their health needs met before they get pregnant, they're seeing better maternal and infant health outcomes compared to states that didn't.
I want to get in the weeds for a minute on a sensitive subject. Not all women have the ability to successfully breastfeed their newborn children, and they have to rely on formula, which is exceptionally expensive. And if we're talking about rural areas and people who are impoverished, would Medicaid changes impact their access to formula?
I don't know if Medicaid changes would directly impact their access to formula, but it would certainly impact their wallets, right? If you don't have health insurance, you have to pay more to get any health coverage. And we already know families are struggling to make ends meet, and formula and other things are getting more expensive. So this would just be another hit to their bottom line.
What's the alternative for these rural hospitals if the Medicaid changes go through? Are there other funding possibilities for them, or are we just looking at mass closures?
No, rural hospitals don't have a backup plan. That Medicaid is an important payer. So I haven't heard of any other alternative. They're already struggling to stay open. These rural hospitals are already working on thin margins, so losing a payer source like Medicaid would be really devastating.
So if I'm sitting in my home on my farm in rural Ohio and I'm hearing this conversation, obviously it's going to upset me. What can I do about it?
You know, we really want to make sure that policymakers that are making decisions particularly quickly understand the role that Medicaid plays in rural communities. And, you know, when rural hospitals close, it's not just the families who rely on Medicaid who are going to suffer. It's every person trying to give birth in that community or get the care they need.
Where can we go to learn more?
Sure. The Center for Children and Families website is at ccf.georgetown.edu.
And I know that not everyone's a report geek like I am, because obviously I like to read these reports. But if somebody wanted to access the report, does that website give them the ability to read it?
Absolutely. It's right on the top of our website.
Okay. I appreciate your time. We want to thank Elizabeth Wright Barak from Georgetown University. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
State lawmakers have until June 30th to present a two-year operating budget to Governor DeWine. The House passed its version in April. Senate Republicans unveiled their 5,500-page, $60 billion budget proposal on Tuesday. It includes a $1.1 billion income tax cut, property tax relief, and investments in public education. Their plan is to lower the top state income tax rate and implement a single flat tax rate. That will happen over the next 2 years if approved. Senate President Rob McCauley and Senate Finance Committee Chairman Jerry Serino held a news conference to lay out the proposal. They say tax cuts can help attract businesses to the state and boost the economy. Right now, the top state income tax bracket in Ohio is 3.5%. That would be lowered to 2.75% for the 2026 tax year. Currently, the 3.5% income tax rate applies to those earning more than $100,000 per year. Those earning between $26,051 and $100,000 pay 2.75%, and those earning up to $26,050 pay zero income tax. That will stay the same in the Republican plan.
Something that we entered into knowing that it had to be a pro-growth, positive budget for the state of Ohio to keep building on the success and the wins that we've had in the state of Ohio as far as economic development and economic growth.
Flat tax, actually what ends up happening is that they are disproportionately very, they pay off the folks at the top of the income brackets, and the folks at the lower end are the losers.
As far as public education goes, Republicans say their plan pumps $634 million more into K-12 schools than the current two-year budget and keeps the basics of the Fair School Funding Plan in place. They also changed a provision passed by the House that would require districts to give property tax money back to homeowners if the district carries over more than 30% of their operating revenue to the next school year. The Senate version would allow school districts to carry over 50% of their operating revenue. Districts could also put funding in a separate account for capital improvement projects. They would have to use that money within 3 years or face a penalty.
We've added more dollars in funding than current law, than the House proposed budget, or the executive proposed budget, $634 million. We're going to let the formula actually work and continue for in its final phase, so there are districts that will get less than they did in 25, but no one will get less than what they received in fiscal 21, as the Fair School Funding Plan was designed to do.
Another big topic this General Assembly has been state funding for a new Cleveland Browns stadium in the suburb of Brook Park. The Ohio House is proposing issuing $600 million in state bonds to pay for the project. Governor DeWine proposed increasing the state tax on sports gambling. Now, the Senate has a different idea. Under the Senate plan, the state would provide $600 million from the state's $3.7 billion unclaimed funds program. From that fund, the state would also set aside another $1.1 billion for other sports stadiums and culture facilities. The Browns will commit $1.2 billion for their stadium project, plus put $50 million in an escrow account and provide a $50 million line of credit. Lawmakers say the money would be paid back with tax revenue from the stadium project.
At no point are we risking the ability of the state to make good on any obligations that it might have for folks or organizations that are claiming or have claims for the unclaimed funds. And with the addition coming in every year, we'll be able to support other projects going forward in the state. What this does is it takes idle money and puts it to work to create jobs, to create incremental taxes, and that's why we're so excited about this project.
Democratic State Senator Bill DeMora of Columbus issued a statement saying he is disgusted by the Senate version of the operating budget. He says, quote, this budget is somehow even worse than what we got out of the House. It is a spit in the face of all Ohioans. He points to the funding of the Brown Stadium while making cuts to food banks, libraries, and the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. There will be more hearings on the two-year budget proposal in the Senate before it goes to the full Senate for a vote. Again, the Senate and House must complete their work on the budget by June 30th.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
In an email to the Jewish community, Jewish Columbus leaders said the community across the country has faced unimaginable terror in recent days. So they are tightening security and warning people to be careful. In the email, they point to what authorities call the targeted killings of two Israeli embassy staffers in Washington, D.C., then the makeshift flamethrower and Molotov cocktail attack in Boulder, Colorado that injured at least 15 people. Investigators say it happened during a peaceful gathering of people showing support for Israeli hostages in Gaza. In response, Jewish Columbus leaders say their security team is working with local, state, and federal law enforcement to address the community's security needs here. They have spoken to the police chiefs of each city that houses a Jewish institution in central Ohio and connected with local clergy and other agencies to coordinate on security. Joining me now are Jewish Columbus President, CEO, Julie Tilson Stanley, and Jewish Columbus's Chief Security Officer, Mike Higgins. Thank you both for joining me today. I really appreciate your time. Julie, I want to start with you. How have the most recent anti-Semitic attacks in D.C. and Boulder, Colorado, impacted the Jewish community here in Central Ohio?
Thanks, Doug. The uptick in anti-Semitic incidences has caused fear and anxiety. And simultaneously, as a community, we are undeterred. And what we are doing and what we're putting in place is helping the community, not just the Jewish community, but the entire Central Ohio community, providing them with different action items that they can do to remain safe. At Jewish Columbus, we believe in a safe and vibrant community. And really, a safe Jewish Columbus community is a safe Columbus community.
Do you feel safe right now, or do you have specific reason to, you know, be beefing up some of these precautions?
We are beefing up because there is uncertainty. And when there's uncertainty, we want to make sure that we have everything in place. And that is why my colleague, Mike Higgins, Chief Security Officer at Jewish Columbus, is here, and why we partner with our law enforcement, our elected officials, and our clergy to make sure that everyone is on the same page and we are able to collaborate with the entire community.
Mike, let me turn to you on that. What are you focusing on right now as Chief Security Officer?
Well, Doug, first and foremost, we are ensuring that we have an armed security presence at all of our locations. We've partnered with local police special duty officers, and when they're not available, we've been hiring and contracting with Armed Security Services. We've followed up with a deep look into our security technologies. We are currently test bedding some remarkable state-of-the-art security systems. They have a lot of capability, and we're looking to deploy those within the next couple months.
What facilities are you focusing on?
All facilities are considered important. We are probably starting off with those who have the least amount of capability right now. We have some that are very well thought out and built out currently. But we are going to probably start out with those that have what we would deem kind of the lower level of self, and bringing them up to par with what we consider state of the art.
And you're talking about schools, synagogues, other Jewish community centers?
Correct.
That kind of thing?
Correct. We have 20 locations, 20 physical institutions that fall within Jewish Columbus's overview. And again, like I said, we've been out, we've looked at all of them, we've done security assessments. We've, where there were some shortfallings, we've addressed those already, and we are moving. We are at a good baseline right now. We are in the process of raising that bar to, like I said, a state-of-the-art security system, including technology, operation centers, and armed security.
And arms presence. Julie, what are you hearing
from the community in terms of, we've seen different attacks and horrible incidents over the years, but now it's just in these last 2-3 weeks, what are you hearing from the community?
We are hearing a lot of unease and questions and hesitation around going to events, whether that's an event at any of our institutions or even around town, if they're wearing a Jewish star or some piece of Judaica on them. People are scared. And anti-Semitism has the anti-Semitic incidences in Central Ohio has increased by 42% since October 7th of 2023.
42%.
42% in Central Ohio. And the Jewish population in the world only makes up 2% of the population. And so it is alarming and concerning. And we know that we always not only have to take our own steps to ensure our safety, but we want to do this in partnership with the entire community.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.